Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students Director of Policy and Public Affairs Ron Matus talks to Fernando Zulueta, founder and president of Academica, one of the most successful charter school organizations in the country that manages over 200 schools in 10 states with some 120,000 students. The two discuss Fernando's background building one of the first charter school organizations, Academica's superb academic outcomes, his thoughts on people trying to tear down the charter school movement, and how his schools plan to tackle and adapt to the growth of educational savings accounts. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Welcome everybody to our podcast, and we have a very special guest today, Fernando Zulueta. Fernando is the founder and president of Academica, which I like to say is maybe the most successful charter school organization that maybe you haven't heard of. And so that's a little bit of what I want to get into. Academica now has about 200 schools. You manage about 200 schools in 10 states, about 120,000 students. Is that roughly correct?
That sounds accurate.
Okay. You started in Florida. You're still big in Florida. You have 120, 130 schools in Florida, 60 or 70,000 kids in Florida. And I'd like to note just real quick, also something that we'll get into later, is that on top of being a big organization, you also, more importantly, have some really good academic outcomes, and I want to talk about that. But Fernando, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you, Ron, and I'm a big fan of your work, and I enjoy reading what you write, because you're an excellent writer, and I like good writing, so I'm a fan of that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, I'm particularly happy that you are a guest today, given the backdrop of what's going on. You know, obviously, there's a lot going on with education choice. You guys are involved with a ton of that. But it's also the 25th birthday of the charter school sector in Florida, which I think is significant. I hope it gets, you know, the attention it deserves. You guys didn't start the very first charter school, but you started one of the first. I think one of the first five, somewhere around in there. And I know there's a really interesting story there, because you didn't come out of the education space. I mean, you have training as a lawyer and as an accountant, and in a past life you were a developer. So tell us a little bit about that. You know, give us the Reader's Digest version of how in the world you came from that realm into the charter school realm.
Well, if we rewind back about 25 years ago, a little more, as I happened to be a lawyer and an accountant, but I was always entrepreneurial. And at the time, for about 10 years or 15 years before that, I had been in the development world, in the world of real estate development here in South Florida, and was very active building new home communities. And these ended up being quite large, in some cases as many as 2,000 new homes in some of the communities I was developing. And back then they're called, you know, master planned communities. And as a developer, you were tasked pretty much with building a small town, really a small, where maybe 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people would be living one day. Mm. And yeah, one of the elements of that is you could build houses. You needed to provide recreation for the folks. And that was like parks, and set aside land for commercial uses so that they could have shopping centers and convenience stores and things like that. The one thing you couldn't do was provide educational or public educational options. And that was particularly vexing for somebody like me, who was primarily developing single family and multifamily home communities for first time home buyers. So these were folks who were just starting families. Mm-hmm. And first question out of their mouth when they come to one of these new communities, typically on weekends, they would ask is, well, how are the schools in the area? And unfortunately, way too many times we had to say we kind of don't have any, because it's a new community, or they're not very good and they're overcrowded. That was a problem that to Florida and certainly South Florida was struggling with. Mm-hmm. So in 96, when the first charter schools law was established in the state, one of the gentlemen that before that had been working with me on land use, you know, work was Congressman Peter Deutsch at the time. Okay. And he was the one that first brought to my attention the whole emerging realm of the charter school world. And that was back in 91 when one of the first charters started up in Minnesota. And Peter sent me a couple of books on school choice. And since he and I were collaborating on these new communities, and they were fascinating things to plan and develop, he was saying, you know, Fern, at one day, you may be able to tackle this issue of being able to provide schools in these communities, because a charter school could be a pathway to that. So I credit Peter with having given me that information and helped me understand a little bit what was happening in the public policy side of things. And sure enough, when Florida passed the first charter school statute in 96, that same year I petitioned to establish one at Somerset, which was a community I was developing in Broward for 2,000 homes. And that was the first Somerset Academy. Initially, I thought we would just be doing something for that community. And I was blown away the following year when we opened up with only 50 students, but we had people coming from 20 miles, 15 and 20 miles away to try to get into that new charter school. Yeah, it was crazy. And we called it Somerset Neighborhood School. We intended it to be, and our charter said, look, this is a school where kids are going to walk to school. We're building a whole new neighborhood for them, and nobody has to drive to it, and they're going to ride their bikes and drive to school. You know, my first instinct was not being an educator. And I read as much as I could about it, but I knew I was nowhere near had the level of knowledge I needed to in this field. I just find the best possible people to run it and give them as much autonomy and control over their environment as possible. And my job was to run interference for them, not interfere with them, you know, in their job.
Right.
So I always viewed my job, and initially it was as a board member or board chair of that organization, was to figure out how I could make their jobs easier. And I kept running into all these roadblocks in doing it. But I learned a great deal, right? And as an accountant, I was running the numbers myself. As a lawyer, I was dealing with all the legal hurdles they had to, you know, jump through in order to make the school operate. And it was crazy. I mean, everything you can possibly imagine happened those first years, including at the end of the first year, our educational results seemed dismal. And we had.
Oh, I didn't know that. Like, really?
Oh, yeah, it was lousy. First year, we were like 30 points behind every possible standard, and I was calculating it myself. We didn't have a rigorous accountability we now had in Florida, so we didn't get a grade or anything. We were like 30 points below state, local, national averages. You know, I was like, okay, so charters don't look like they're going to be working very well. What I neglected to, and thank God I persevered, because, it was highly disappointing that first year. But I said, you know, we're going to keep trying. Let's see what happens. I deeply believed that we had great teachers in the classroom, and I respected the work they were doing, and I was witnessing it. So I was a little bit confused over why the students didn't seem to be doing as well as kids in other schools. The thing we didn't know back then is that we weren't really measuring learning gains yet. We were measuring status, right?
Right, right.
And the other thing we weren't aware was that the reason people showed up from 15 and 20 miles away is that they had children who were struggling in the traditional public school system. So the folks that came seeking us out were folks who were desperate and were looking, and they viewed charter schools as this potential, you know, magic wand that they could wave and cure the ills that they were, you know, struggling with. And year two was a huge eye opener. And that's the year that we were able to move into a permanent building from a temporary facility on the site, where we began the year by sending students on a permanent field trip every day because the hurricane threatened and the building that was being finished wasn't ready on time because everything had to be unloaded in August from the roof and everything. So we spent about 2 months of the beginning of the year on field trips. I think we had, it was pretty funny. I mean, it's not funny. It wasn't funny at the time. The district was threatening to shut us down. They were sending us letters. I had an appendicitis and a ruptured appendix. I was in the hospital getting phone calls from a Sun Sentinel reporter who was telling me what the superintendent was going to do to our charter because we were not did not have an appropriate learning environment for children as they were going on field trips to the science museum every day, to state parks. They were having the best. The kids were learning more than they ever had.
I didn't know any of that happened. I assumed that you set up this charter school. It was a rousing success. You had people flocking from all over. I know what your outcomes are now. So I figured you guys hit the ground running. But it sounds like there was a lot of trial and error there.
We kind of hit the ground falling. So it's like, gravity. So we bounced off the pavement a few times after we hit. And then we rolled over and bounced again. You know what I mean? So it was crazy. The district wanted to shut us down every possible way. Every day was a new threatening letter. And I was fighting with the superintendent and some of the other folks there through the paper because I was in a hospital, on a drip, recovering from a ruptured appendix. And I was at the school the day it ruptured. So it was really agonizing. And in fact, what we did, it was before we did some crazy stuff. It was right before the October count. This was August. Uh-huh. So we knew that the only students that would count would be the ones that were enrolled in October. So since the district was threatening to shut us down and we still had a temporary facility where we could, that was fully approved, where we could host students. What we did at one point is we found a private school nearby and those were really nice folks in a private school nearby. So I actually personally, offered the parents that we couldn't accommodate in the building that was under construction to house them at the private school and pay their full tuition there for a month or two. And then we would send our own teachers to the private school. So the private school was very graciously had some empty classrooms. So they let us have like two or three classrooms there. We took our own teachers over there. And then the students disenrolled from the charter and enrolled in the private school. Yes. Our teachers were then paid privately off. They were no longer public school students for about a month and a half. This was a lot of fun. And then so one day I'm on the phone finally with the guy from the district and he is, you can't have our kids going on field trips. And I go, well, first of all, they're not your kids. And second of all, they're not on field trips. They're in a school already. And they're going, what do you mean? I go, check your computer. So he looks, he goes, what did you do with our children? Because there were like 30 kids missing or 40 kids, 50 kids, something like that, disappeared from the enrollment roll. And they're like, where'd you take my children? And I'm like, first of all, they're not your children. The parents, each parent decided to go to a private school nearby, which I happen to be paying privately for them until that building's ready. And if they get back during the school year, we'll welcome them back once the building's finished. So you're done for now. And please don't refer to them as your children anymore because you don't own them and they're not yours. They're the parents and they're the ones that get to choose. And so sure enough, we finished the building and right before the beginning of the official count of the school year, they all re-enrolled back in the charter school. So we were able to start the year. And the best part about it was that at the end of that school year, though we had the highest results in the state for second grade, the SAT, the Stanford Achievement Test, the little, the SAT 9 or SAT 10 that they used to take at the time. So there was an article about it. Somerset, this new startup charter, all of a sudden is ahead of 2,000 other charter schools in the state of, or other schools, public schools in the state of Florida on their educational outcomes. So we had like a 60 percentile swing or 50 from one year to the next.
So despite all that rocky beginnings, despite all that hitting the ground falling, you actually you actually worked it out. So the kids
were
learning.
The whole program turned around. It was a roaring success. The parents were super happy. They were our partners the entire time. So we empowered them and they empowered us. It was awesome.
Well, so you guys started there. That was number one. And so here you roll forward 20 years and you got 200 schools and you got 120,000 kids. And just like that initial school that after your initial stumbles got some great outcomes, you're getting some pretty good outcomes with your affiliated networks overall. And I want to turn to that because, you know, part of the reason that I wanted to talk to you is I don't think you guys get the recognition for some of the outcomes. And I could be wrong, so you could shoot down my theory, but just...
No, I think you're right. I'm cool with that. We never did this for recognition in the first place. So not whether we get it or not is really, in my, you know, I don't view that as important or necessary. The only thing that's helpful is that it helps inform public policy and it does help parents make informed decisions on, you know, the fact that charter schools can have a dramatic and positive impact in their children's lives and in the trajectory of their education. So I think that part is important.
Well, absolutely. And you know,
well, that's your job, Ron. You're the communicator.
I did want to communicate this part about your outcomes because it seems to be missing. Now, what you said is so on point. I mean, at the end of the day, the fact that you're growing and you're popular and parents are continuing to flock your schools, I think that's the best indicator of quality. There's always a handful or a couple handful of academic affiliated schools at the very top of those lists, whether it's the Florida list or the national list. All those things are great. The thing, and I could be wrong about this, the thing that I gravitated towards most was what the Credo group found. So the Credo Center at Stanford, I think it's fair to say, is probably the most highly regarded analyses of charter school performance over the past decade or so. They may have been, you know, doing that research even before, but at least for the past decade, you know, they're kind of the gold standard of how well charter schools are doing. And back 2017, 2018, they did analyses of all the different charter school networks, scores and scores of them. I can't even remember how many they had in there. But the results for your main networks that you manage, Doral, Mater, Somerset, Pinecrest, Ben Gamla was, I don't know how many Ben Gamla schools you have now, but your outcomes there are not only really good relative to the comparisons to the district kids, because that was their methodology, but also in relation to plenty of other charter school networks that are highly regarded and seem to be getting, you know, a lot of deserved positive attention for their academic progress. Can you talk a little bit more about the Credo outcomes? I mean, I can ramble on more about that, but is that a significant thing to look at? Why is that important? And, you know,
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's very important because what Credo does is they actually, it isn't just a statistical analysis. They actually survey 100% of the population itself. Mm-hmm. So you're getting population level data. It's big data. Mm-hmm. It's like they're basically reporting on the results of every student in a charter school in America. And I think it was like 300 and some networks or groups that were mentioned in the study. And then they classify them under a different structural, how they're organized. And what I thought was pretty cool was they created, they have like the pure, let's say what they call the CMO schools, and then which are the KIPPS of the world that are nonprofit organized entirely. Then they have the VOS, they call the vendor operated schools that are more, tend to be operated more by for-profit organizations or companies like that. But then they created a new category, and that's where our schools by and large fell in. And those are what they call the hybrid category. And that is a category of CMOs that are like these charter management organizations, like you mentioned, Matter Academy, Pinecrest, Doral, Somerset, Bingamla, and others. And that those organizations contract for part of their services with another organization like Academica, but they are self-managed. So we don't really manage them. I kind of have a lot of faith in people's ability to manage, you know, like manage themselves. And part of the reason we're not known to, you know, out there as much is that we're not seeking to brand these schools as Academica schools. We're not looking to do it. We love the fact that Matter is its own wonderful, beautiful organism that gets to have its own board. Many of the board members, in fact, now more and more are actual alumni of those networks. So one of the fascinating things is that these are now young, very young people who are in their 20s or in some cases approaching or at 30 already, but they're very young people who are now joining these boards and helping to run these networks. When we're talking about, and I know you've been asking, well, Fern, what is it that works? It's all these little things. It's when you're building an organization, you're building something in the ether. It's a work of thought, right? It's a work of ideas and of intangibles. And we're always really amazed with these other things out there that are also primarily the work of thought and intangibles, but they have a tangible manifestation. It's like an iPhone or a computer or something like that. But in reality, some of the greatest works that we do as humans are entirely in the ether. We create great countries, great companies, great organizations, right out there, for profit and nonprofit. Like I always say, beware about false profits more than anything. Don't worry so much about for and nonprofit, because ultimately they're run by people and they have the same, any one of them, governmental, nonprofit, for profit, religious, whichever it is, can have the same flaws as the individuals that are involved in operating it. So they're human things, and we have our failings and our limitations. But if we're positive about what we do and we try to leverage and marshal the energy and the drive that people have when you're given freedom, when they're given autonomy, and when they're given the opportunity to be masters of their own destinies, I think we can create great things. And that's what we try to do.
So you listed many things that seem to be part of your part of the academic culture, which you feel mm-hmm. like have led to the success that you've had. If I could go back just a second to go back to the outcomes. So, you know, you listed things that help you get those outcomes.
Oh, yeah. No, you were mentioning that. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's...
No, but I neglected. Yeah, so the study where they classified us as a hybrid organization.
Right, those hybrids, if I remember
right. They listed
right.
our results separately.
Well, the hybrids.
And if you look at it, the hybrids are way above everyone else.
Right.
Yeah, well, they're alone.
Well, so here's my question. You know, that group got singled out as getting the best outcomes.
Right.
You know, you look at the networks in those groups, all positive, all really good, all good compared to, again, lots of other networks. And I wrote down some of them: Democracy Prep, Achievement First, BASIS, IDEA, Yes Prep, Great Hearts. I mean, your outcomes are on par with those. You know, you hear about them, but you don't hear is, and again, maybe it's me and I'm in my bubble, you know, but why? So you're now one of the biggest, if not the biggest, right, charter school management organization in the country. And you have these networks that you manage that are getting really good results in all kinds of different ways, not only with parental satisfaction and demand, obviously, but all these other outcomes and ways you can measure things. Is it simply that you haven't tried to call attention to yourself? I mean, what is your theory as to why, you know, you're not more in the conversation with these other networks?
You know, my theory behind it is that each network is its own important branch of an ecosystem, and they need to each stand separately, which they do. So, for example, this year, finally, Matter Academy received the largest federal replication grant in the nation, was awarded that by the U.S. Department of Education. So Matter has been tasked now with doubling in size in the next 5 years. And the first
piece
of that grant was close to $20 million. The total grant is in the range of $60 million. So it's that's a huge recognition of the work of one of the networks.
Definitely.
That was part of the underpinning of what we did is we created an ecosystem where what we were trying to do with Academic is actually make it as cost effective as possible for these networks to grow. So anything that wasn't mission critical to the task of educating students is what Academica sought to do, because we felt you don't want your educational leaders burdened with thinking about things that don't really resonate in the classroom. So
you take that off their hands.
Right. We take it off their hands, and that you can scale, and that you can get economies of scale. So if you look back, what Academica costs a school network is typically less than what similar schools have pay sometimes a public provider like a school district, for example, or even a nonprofit. We've been compared, and Miami-Dade County Public Schools, for example, did a comparison a few years back when they decided to start and manage their own group of charter schools. And I remember they listed 10 providers, and Academica was the lowest cost provider in that list. They showed that, you know, standalone charter schools, those actually had the toughest time when you dealt with costs like that. See, we have an entire legal department on hand at Academica. We employ 8 lawyers or more that deal with a lot of the compliance duties. That alone can become an enormous cost for an individual charter school, is hiring lawyers at $500 to $700 an hour or whatever they can cost nowadays. Well, we can deliver it at a very cost-effective manner by having it all within one organization. The same for HR, you know, human resource, back office work, accounting, all of these things. See, none of those things, you don't put lawyers in classrooms, right, to teach the students. So you really, you know, if we can figure out how to bundle those things and scale them so that everyone can benefit from them, then it creates a net benefit for everyone. And in fact, in many cases, the work we do internally then becomes the model for other charter schools, so they can save some money, and I'm good with that too.
I wonder if you, Academica and its networks it helps to manage, might not get some of the positive recognition it deserves because of the fact that you are for profit. Because there are some people who have this hang up about that designation. There's some people.
Yeah, and that's too bad because, you know, it's the foundation of this nation, is the part of it. I don't think without the private sector, which is essentially the for-profit sector, you know, I don't think you have a viable economy. I don't think you have a viable nation. And I think when we try to vilify the hard work that Americans do around our nation, building companies and creating wealth for the nation and giving jobs to folks, and somehow saying that for-profit is a bad word or something that we should strive to get away from, that's just wrong. So this is this is the false prophet situation. It's some people that have an axe to grind with charter schools in general, and it's not a bad strategy, by the way. The strategy is figure out, it's called divide and conquer. So try to find out something that's different about that organization or those organizations, and try to drive a wedge between them and other folks that are pursuing that activity, and you'll do better in the court of public opinion. Well, and you'll finish them.
I think we have seen that over the past year, yeah. Right? There is an attempt to drive a wedge between quote unquote for-profit charters and non-profit charters. I mean, that was a plank in the Democratic Party platform, and I don't mean to be bringing up politics here and not pointing fingers at anybody, but that seems to be an example of what you're referring to.
Exactly, and I think that properly, I think we're you had the best commentary on it early on in this podcast, which was you said, and you brought up the most important point, which is that the ultimate accountability is the fact that nobody's assigned to a charter school, but rather the parents are the ones that need that make the decision whether that's a good place for their children to be educated.
Right.
And there's this rather demeaning and unfortunate notion among some folks in the public sector that they're just much smarter than everyone else, and that they're the ones that should be making those decisions for parents or for other people in different circumstances. And that's exactly what we're trying to fight. We're trying to, you know, educate our children in our schools. And my children go to our schools, so I'm right. one of those parents. So we're trying to educate them to be critical thinkers and to understand what, you know, and look behind the smokescreen that some folks tend to put up at times. And I can tell you, and this is pretty funny, because you've seen these reports out there by our so-called enemies. And the things that is striking is that they very rarely, if ever, mention educational outcomes in them.
Oh, well, there you go. I was going there. So
you go there because it is a glaring thing. And anybody with just a modicum of intelligence can look at that and say, but wait a second, isn't this supposed to be about education? Because you seem to be focusing on how these folks are organized, whether it's for-profit or nonprofit or governmental or God knows what else. Mind you, I've never seen ringing endorsements from anybody for the DMV or any other of these governmental, you know, services that are delivered out there. So why we think that government is uniquely suited to deliver education, but we complain bitterly about everything else that government tasks itself with delivering, is far beyond me to understand. However, I can tell you one thing, that if you want innovation, then you empower the private sector. And I'm not saying the for-profit sector, I'm just saying the private sector. Because these same folks, if you read, they speak with forked tongue, and I will explain. They, on the one hand, they'll write stuff that says, oh, these for-profit guys are horrible, they're villains, look at them, they've had horns on their head, you know, and they're out there, you know, cashing in on kids. They've used statements like that. Meanwhile, they'll get on a different forum and they'll say, those nonprofits, they're horrible. They're the same folks, the ones that they're just trying to drive a wedge between us. But they'll say, those are private companies. Those aren't doing the public good. They're just private, you know, nonprofits. And they use, like, you know, quotation marks. But they're not really doing God's work, because the only people that know how to do God's work are the government.
I think you answered the question I was going to ask about a specific new report that came out, but just to throw this out, I guess it's the Network for Public Education.
Carol Burris, I believe, yes. Right, is the author, the so-called author. I mean, she's just, it's somebody who's a stooge for the unions, basically. They write. They're mouthpieces. And by the way, we can all be accused of being one, and I'll take my lumps along with everybody else, but you know what? Then compare results with everybody else. It's like, you can talk trash all you want, but when you get out on the ball field, find out who's scoring the points, right? So we, you know, look, we've got
I'm a baseball dad, so that analogy works with me.
You know how it works. People like to talk trash. And I view that report as just one big pile of trash, too. They're just talking trash. And by the way, and they ding everybody in it, right? Anybody, for-profit, non-profit, whomever, right? What I've seen, it doesn't matter. They just have an agenda. But unfortunately, they're missing the point. And you brought up the most important point, which is when you get people who are doing some serious research over at Stanford, for example, and they look at the data, they inevitably find that the charter schools are helping create, you know, better outcomes for kids.
Fern, we're running out of time. So there's this one area that I wanted to turn to just real quick. And I'm sorry we ran out of time, because I know you guys do more than just charter schools. I mean, you guys, I did want to just at least mention in passing. I mean, you're getting involved in higher ed. You got an international diploma program that's thousands of kids in multiple countries now. You've got a virtual education arm that's amazing. And I'm sorry we ran out of time to talk about all that. But the hot topic You know, for us, and I think for the state, and what you're seeing, you know, more written about than charter schools, frankly, right now, are education savings accounts. I mean, quite a buzz about that, and for good reason, I think. You know, just real quickly, what do you think of that idea? Where do you think it's headed? And how are charter schools going to evolve with that? What's your reading of the tea leaves with education savings accounts?
Look, I'm in favor of them. Anything that empowers parents and to access better quality education, what they believe is better quality. I believe the consumer is always right. Even, you know, you got to let the folks who have most at stake, and that is the parents. They're the ones for whom education is most critical and most important, right? Because their future and the future of their families depend on the quality of the education their children receive. So anything we can do to empower parents is the right thing. And I firmly believe that. I'm a student of, you know, competitive theory, big fan of Michael Porter, the work he did at Harvard over the years. And a lot of it came down to, you know, anything you do to help the consumer helps the industry itself. He was studying the competitive advantage of nations, for example, in one of his famous books. And it's the same way for education. If you empower the consumer, however you can, you end up with a better product in the end. I think Miami-Dade County is an example. We have far better schools today than we had 20 some years ago.
How do charter schools stay ahead of a system where parents are going to be able to choose things a la carte?
Look, like they say, the devil's in the details a lot of times. I mean, you do need an environment for children to go to sometimes. Parents, it would be unwieldy for them to move around during a school day from location to location. But I'm certainly an advocate of what I believe is the learning center model. And we're designing some of our newer products that way. We're looking at that as just what I think is maybe a smarter way to approach it. And I'm in favor of saying, well, you know, we're looking at hybrid delivery models right now as what I think we're heading toward, right? Mm-hmm. Where you need to have a certain amount of in-person learning. Mm-hmm. But frankly, I learn a whole lot online, right? I spend hours daily looking at YouTube videos, and it's not entertainment ones. Although they're entertaining sometimes, but they're typically about knowledge and information. And I read a lot. I read a lot of journals and stuff. So I get my knowledge that way. And I learn that way. So I think the role of the school or the educators as facilitators and guides, not just delivering the you know, teaching, but being almost like a trainer is a physical trainer. It's somebody that helps guide you on your journey of learning. And I think we need to really, really start looking at that. And I personally want to do those types of things. I believe that that's why I created a college, you know, 12 years ago, and it's fully accredited now. And then our students are accelerating through middle school and high school. We're going to graduate a student this coming year with a full 4-year college degree out of high school.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Vern, do you see charter schools, you know, another big term that comes around with education savings accounts is unbundling of services. Right. I mean, how do charter schools do that? Can they do that? Will they do that? What does that look like going forward?
I think some of it you can unbundle. Some of them, and I'm looking forward to figuring out how and being part of the solution and not part of the problem. I'm certainly not the one who's going to be standing in the way of that kind of public, you know, initiative. I think you learning something new is painful. It is. In fact, that's the definition of almost learning something, right? It's painful. Like when you learn to walk, you fall down, that hurts. But you learn to walk, so you learn not to fall down as often. And it's the same with anything like this. But if we do nothing, then nothing will certainly happen. But if we look to the future and try to figure out ways to do that and to bring the best tools out there to help our children, then I think we'll be better in the end for it. So I think it's our duty and you know to work hard to try to make some of those innovations happen. So I'm all for them.